Hello, and welcome to episode 248 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
People today often seem anxious about the future, whether it's politics, the economy, climate change, or even artificial intelligence. At the same time, we also have more tools than ever to help us navigate those challenges. We can instantly access information, connect with people around the world, and use technology to make many parts of life easier and more efficient. And historically, that's largely been a good thing. Human progress, in many ways, is a story of reducing hardship. But I've been wondering whether there's a tension built into that progress. Because while people naturally seek comfort and convenience, human beings also seem to need challenge, uncertainty, and forward momentum in order to feel engaged and alive. If too much effort and discomfort disappear from our lives, do we risk becoming passive instead of purposeful? At the same time, I don't think the answer is rejecting technology or romanticizing hardship. Every generation seems to adapt to new tools and new realities. The challenges sometimes just change. So, Rick, let's start here. Why do you think human beings seem to need challenge and uncertainty in order to thrive, even as we constantly work to make our lives easier?
Well, the easy answer to this is just the fact that we are biological creatures, and this is the way biology works. Anything that doesn't get used on a regular basis starts to atrophy. So we know that with muscles, right? If you use it or lose it.
Maybe your mind too.
But yeah, brains are the same way, and we know that you lose brain cells, you lose these neural synapses if you don't use your mind. That's why it's so important to learn new things if you want to keep a healthy brain as you get older. Two of the best ways of doing that is making new social connections, so being active socially, and learning new hobbies, so you're exercising your mind in different ways. So we do seem to need new challenges, but the main thing is we just need to stay active in some respect.
And I think you're using that term active pretty broadly. As I was thinking about this, let's pick something ridiculously obvious, but like fire. I mean, at some point, man invented fire, and you and I would both not want to be in a world where we have not mastered the use of fire. And, you know, there's other like things like just basic tools and the wheel and things like that that obviously have downsides, have risks. I mean, since the dawn of time, millions of people have probably been killed by fire. We've created weapons that have also killed, you know, hundreds of millions of people. So, I mean, like these things all come with risks, and anything we develop often does. And I guess maybe the question I'm trying to get at is, you don't think that we should like stop creating ways to make our lives better, even if we know there's going to be some unintended consequences, do you?
One of the complaints about technology by some is it allows us to stop doing the work that the technology is designed to replace. That is partly true, but the more important thing is, like, what kind of choices do we make in our individual life? And are we leading a life where we're just seeking comfort and stasis, or are we leading a life in which we're moving forward to the next thing? And we know that people only flourish when they are moving on towards the next thing. So in some ways, You have to live a future-oriented life. You have to have some goals or purpose and be actively moving towards them. Now, you can use technology to accomplish quite a bit in your life. You just can't use it to take care of all your, say, your survival tasks and then think, oh, I've got it made. Now I can just rest. Rest is not a goal.
Even though some people probably don't feel like this some of the time, that in general, people living on the earth today have tremendous amounts of more leisure time than they had before. In a lot of ways, I mean, that's like what we've been working for, right? I mean, most of us who are work full time, you know, have 40-hour work weeks and try to work 5 days and things like that. Why? Well, because we wanted to claw back some of the time we had been giving to, you know, work, oftentimes very hard and grueling and physically demanding work, and create more free time for ourselves. But I think you've talked about on the show before, though, that assuming that you're of able mind and body, there is such thing as too much leisure time. And I think that's what people, what you're talking about when you're saying people need a challenge is, it can look, can be many different things, but it just can't be nothing.
Yeah. And the word leisure is really interesting, because that is the way that we translate into English the Greek word skola, from which we get the word school, and scholastics and scholarly and all those words. The Greeks had these concept of skola, which is leisure, and askola, which is not leisure or work. And they thought one of the things that you work in order that you can have leisure. But leisure isn't a time simply not to work. It is the positive accomplishment you make. Like that is the opportunity you have for building all kinds of cultural achievements in your society, but then for your own personal life, you have time to then pursue things that are of your choice and not given to you by necessity. And we tend to use the word leisure as just time off, like loafing, like time for doing nothing. That would have been a foreign concept to the Greeks. And also, like, I think that's kind of admirable on their part, is that they seem to have this insight that you want free time for the sake of what you can accomplish using that free time.
And I think we can all think of things in our lives and in the lives of people we know, that the times that we feel like we're getting the most done are the times when we're really kind of working toward a goal. And I'm thankful that I've not had to do this recently, but I can think of the many times, especially when I was younger, where I had to move. And that is like a lot of work. And, you know, even if you hire movers, it's still a lot of work. And in my case, oftentimes I wasn't hiring movers. And that's something that is physically demanding, takes some work planning, takes some organization, not only you have to find a new place to live, all these things. You know, you get done, though, and if you do it well, I mean, it does give you sort of a sense of accomplishment, right?
Yeah.
Is that you feel like, wow, I really did. I had a deadline in a way. I had to get a lot of stuff done, and you know, hopefully I did it well. And I think that there are certainly things that come along in all of our lives, like, well, we have to move in 2 months. Let's get ready. But for those who don't have those things that are coming up regularly or often at all, do you sort of have to find ways to challenge yourself and to give yourself and kind of hold yourself accountable, like you do if you're, you know, having to, you know, pack up all your things and move all your stuff?
So this is the challenge that living in a fairly prosperous and technologically advanced society, it presents us with this kind of obligation to find things to occupy our time. Because our days are not filled up, for most of us, just trying to survive. We can do nothing if we choose to, and that can be really harmful. In fact, it's one of the things I write about in my column, is like comfort is the great killer of people. It just destroys lives, and you can't be seeking a life of comfort. It's a directionless, goalless life. So the question is, like, so what do you seek? And so you have to choose something. And there's a lot of things you can choose. A lot of people choose some kind of hobby. A lot of people choose some kind of pro-social activity. They join organizations, or they volunteer to help their neighbors. Or, you know, there can be a variety of things we can do. But just in order to feel good about your life, you need some forward movement in it towards some kind of goal.
But I want to stop on that for a second, because we all know there are people who, if you say, you have to be more involved in your community, meet new people. They're like, oh, no, I just naturally do that, right? That's something that comes natural to some people. I mean, I guess we often call them extroverts, right? That's right. Like their natural sense of being. But this isn't about that you're talking more about ways to challenge yourself. For that, would it be a challenge for that person necessarily to do what you describe? It would be, though, for someone who's very insular, who's more introverted, and that would be the challenge. So it really does, I guess, vary what that challenge is, because it is easy to fall into the trap of comfort. Like, well, I like being around people. And I just heard Rick say being around people is good, so I'm going to do that. I mean, I'm sure you would say that's fine, but you also should identify something that maybe is a challenging part or something that would challenge you.
Something that challenges you to get out of your comfort zone, which is not the same as saying do something that you dislike. Well, you can do a lot of things that you like that are still pushing you to do it a little bit better, for example. And so, like, I have some hobbies. Like, I tie flies. Okay? Well, I can learn a few patterns and then just sit down and just, you know, tie dozens of those patterns. I can also learn some other ones that were, like, the first few aren't very good and then gradually get better. There is a certain pleasure in that activity, but the pleasure generally comes from learning it, from overcoming the obstacle of not being able to do it well and getting to do it better. So you can challenge yourself socially. You can challenge yourself artistically, trying to write poetry if you've never done it before, or trying to write music or listen to music that you haven't listened to before and trying to understand it. Like, there's all kinds of things that we can do. A lot of those things, we find them very enjoyable. But the key thing is finding enjoyment in the struggle, if that makes sense, which is, it's a kind of work. Training ourselves to enjoy the process of overcoming the difficulties and not settling for what we're really comfortable with. Because comfort quickly translates into boredom.
And you say that, it makes me think of, and I've So I think of something from way back in my past. I have read very few books about, like, how to be a better employee, how to, and maybe that's a bad thing to admit, but, you know, there's all sorts of, like, self-help books around, like, work. And I think I've read very few. There was one, though, somebody gave me a long time ago, and I don't know why she gave it to me. Maybe there was a reason, maybe there wasn't. But the premise of the book was that so often, at least in our professional lives, we're encouraged to, like, you know, evaluate or have someone else evaluate our skill set. And, you know, maybe there's two or three things that we're lacking on, and those are the things that we should spend time building up those skills and becoming better at. This book took a very different approach. It said, in fact, don't identify the two or three things you're not especially good at. Instead, identify the two or three things you're really pretty good at and show an interest in, and, like, become just like a excellent performer on those two or three things. To me, it made a lot of sense, and maybe also because it's, like, seems easier to, like, focus on the things that you're already naturally interested in and good at, and then, like, try to be even better at those things. Obviously, I don't think have read this book, and I can't remember the title, and it was out probably 2 decades ago. But just hearing that, intuitively, does one of those, at least in the workplace, sound like better advice?
Yeah. In fact, I've got a quote that's similar to this, like hanging up on a bulletin board in my office. It says, find what you're good at and be better at it than anybody else. Like, that is, like, really refine one skill or one particular talent. And I think it goes to the fact that there's two directions we can take for expanding our life. And one is depth, like becoming really good at some particular thing. The other is expanding our range of skills or range of knowledge or range of experiences.
And each of those things can be challenging in and of themselves.
And in different ways.
Yeah.
And I think it's good to work on both. So I think you should address, like, what am I not familiar with or not very good at? Maybe I should, like, learn more about some of those things.
Try to become average.
Yeah, yeah. It's just familiarize yourself with some things. And then work at becoming really good at a few things. So I write about in my column about, like, how I watched my dad's life I would say for the last 15 years of his life or so, become a really uninteresting person. He had been an active person who was also really creative, and he was learning, as you know, later in life, he taught himself how to paint, and he was painting landscapes, and he did some portraits. The portraits weren't very good, but like he was learning something new, and it was kind of exciting to see. We'd go and visit him, and he'd have half a dozen paintings that he had done. He was always making things, especially for grandchildren, making toys, wood toys, and different things. And then the last few years, he just stopped doing anything. And it was really sad to see, because he stopped doing anything that was hard. Now, part of it was some arthritis, and he wasn't feeling as good, and he had some, you know, he had like his knees hurt, and he seemed to lose all interest in life, and at the same time, he seemed to lose interest in other people's life too. I mean, this just happened. So he had a Lazy Boy recliner, and he would sit in that all day long and sometimes sleep in it at night, you know? Like, that's no way to live. And I compare it to other people that I knew at the time when I was growing up, like my maternal grandmother, Bernice, who she had a lot of aches and pains, and she was getting older, but she was working in her garden. She was cooking new things. She was never a very good cook, but she was like trying new things. She was volunteering at the nursing home. Like, she was finding ways to fill her days right up to the point where she died. And because of that, she was a very interesting person to go and visit with. And she found life kind of exciting all the way along. In fact, in some ways, I think her last 10 years or so of her life were her best, because she had more freedom at that time, and she was learning new things and trying new things. These are very different approaches to life. And I just see a lot of people that take my dad's path.
And you know, clearly, like you said, there can be some health issues and some other mitigating circumstances. But in almost every case, though, this is like a choice, right? I just can't imagine, though I certainly have never met your father, but I can't imagine he said one day, this is just how I'm going to live the last 10 years of my life. That this sort of happened. He let it happen to him. Is that maybe a way to say it?
Yeah, he let it happen. And it became habitual.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would get up in the morning, make his pot of coffee, sit down and have a couple cigarettes and do crossword puzzles. But it was the same thing every single morning. And he wasn't getting out of the house. And this is what happens to a lot of lonely people, is their life becomes very repetitive.
And very small. I
mean, very small. And then there's a lot of rumination, is thinking back on the past and living, you know, life in the rearview mirror. That's not good. You know, like we ought to be forward moving creatures.
And I remember, and this I'm sure is not, he's not the only person to have ever said this or thought this, but there's a John Bonus, who is a podcaster I listen to. He talks about baseball most of the time, but he'll often say, whether it's about baseball or life in general, it's not where you're at, it's what way you're heading. And yeah. I think that's what you're, in a lot of ways, what you're saying.
It makes life exciting because you're looking forward to the next thing. And you don't have to do like great things. It can be really small challenges that you set for yourself. I was in a state forest. My wife and I were camping this past holiday weekend in a state forest, and there's all these bird sounds around us and a lot of songs I hadn't heard before. And I wouldn't call myself a birder. I know a few bird songs, but I'd pull out the Merlin app, so I'm using technology to identify what the bird calls are, and then just sitting at our campsite and discovering new birds, and some that I'd never heard of. And it was really interesting. It's a little thing.
Yeah.
But I was doing something that I don't normally do. I'm trying to learn about a half a dozen new bird calls and identify the species. Very simple.
So I'm going to say something that's probably going to make me unpopular, but I'll say it anyway. you know, most of my job, if not almost all of my job, is like using computers in new and different ways. And I'm not going to convince you or anyone that I am like the smartest tech guy in America, but like I feel pretty comfortable around the technology I use, or if something new comes up, I'm like relatively confident I can, you know, figure it out. Also, guess how many computer classes I've had in my lifetime?
Probably none.
I think I have. I either the answer is none, or it was like part of one class when I was like in like middle school, maybe. And I don't. I like it was like
way
basic
back then
programming.
Where they had those basic.
Yeah, where you like type in command, like, you know, 100. You know, write the word blue, 200. Right, you know, and then you run these little programs. I mean, again, whatever. I mean, I was. I guess it got me typing and looking at a screen, but I mean, there's no practical, you know, knowledge that I gained from that back then. And I just think of people, I mean, I'm in my 50s. I think of people who are older than me, even older than you, Rick, and who just like give up on technology and they just feel like they can never pick this up. And like we were both born before there were smartphones and laptops and things that we take for granted now. And again, we both can use them and it's an important part of our jobs. And sometimes, like you said, sometimes, you know, you discovering new things about the world when you're out on a Memorial Day weekend camping trip. And is it too simplistic to say that people who, whether it's technology or other new things in the world, just sort of think, well, I don't need to know that anymore. I've learned everything I need to learn, and I just don't have curiosity about that. To me, if I ever reach that point, and I hope I don't, that's what I'm going to officially call myself, an old person.
Well, and it is a phenomenon, you know, like most people continue for the rest of their lives listening to the music that was popular when they were in high school.
Well, and I am guilty of that, right? Like, yeah. I mean, I think the other day I was, or whenever the Grammys were, more than the other day, but I was looking at who was nominated and like how many, I mean, very few, a lot of the artists I didn't know. I mean, some of them probably, I do know who Taylor Swift is, but like, could I identify more than a song or two of hers? Maybe not. And you're right. That is sort of a different thing where, you know, the music of the best music ever made is the music that was popular when you were in high school in most cases.
But that's just one area where you can just work a little bit to expose yourself to music from other areas. And pretty soon you expand the range of things that you can take enjoyment in.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of symbolic of so many things. Is it like we stick to a lot of the activities that we did when we were younger, or things that we learned to do and that we're comfortable doing. It's not good for us in the sense that it robs us of energy. Like it is so energizing to go out and to learn how to do something new that you haven't done before. So I like to try to do every year, pick up one new hobby or something, like just to learn a little bit more about it. And then, of course, you can't in 1 year, most hobbies, you can't get very far into them. You can't develop a lot of skills. But just to have some familiarity with how does this work. So a few years ago, I started trying to learn a little bit more about knife making. So like how to grind steel and make the handles and sharpen knives really well and all that stuff. It was incredibly fun. And also really difficult. Like there's a huge knowledge curve but it expanded the range of things that I think I understand. Like I had to learn a lot about different kinds of metals and different steels and the composition of different steels that I just never paid much attention to before, right? So the more you learn new things, the more you just kind of learn about the world around you, what goes into it. And it turns out you just don't have enough time in the day to do all the things that you would like to do.
So I want to stop on the knife example for a second. Well, you'd made this decision. You want to learn more about knife making. There, you could have gotten a book, you could have watched a documentary, you could have watched some YouTube videos, you could have read some other stuff. I mean, what was sort of, or was it kind of an all of the above approach?
Mostly online forums. Mm-hmm. I would just learn and descriptions how to do something. I watched a few YouTube videos on different things.
Watch the movie Braveheart.
Yeah, I don't remember doing that, but it's a small thing. But mainly, I grew up working with wood. My dad was a very skilled woodworker, and he had a shop, and we repaired antique furniture and built a lot of things. And so I learned a lot about wood, but I never understood metal. And my dad had not worked with it at all. I had never learned anything about it, and I thought, like, I just need to know more about, like, what is this substance? Like, what, you know, like, what is the difference between the different steels? And what drove me to it was really, like, the dissatisfaction with our kitchen knives that were always dull and not finding a good way to sharpen them. And first, like, just learning, like, how do you sharpen knives really well? And then you start learning, well, there's some steels you can't sharpen very well, and a lot of cheap knives are made so that, like, they'll take an edge quickly, but then they also dull very quickly. And so then that progressed into, well, maybe I could try grinding my own knives and doing some of that. And so it was just a progression that didn't come from any particular decision. Like, I didn't decide, oh, I'm going to make a knife. It was just like a progression of inquiry.
But I think the problem maybe is that you've talked about gambling on this show, right?
Yeah.
And you think gambling's bad, and I don't. And I
because
think,
it's passive.
Yeah. Well, but the other point is this. I'm trying to get at, though, is that it's not. And obviously, a lot of gambling's worse than a little gambling. But there's no such thing as, like, good gambling, right? I mean, there just isn't. But in your case, when you're talking about knife making, you did turn to, like, technology to get this, you know, to learn about these things. And I guess you probably could have gone to the library or bought a book that tried to give you some of the same information, but it's not where you naturally turned. And I think looking at a video of something, especially knife making, would probably be more useful in some ways than reading a book. But I guess why I draw this distinction is that we've talked since we started the show here today about how technology can make us more passive and make us sort of lean back and kind of tune out on the world, whether it's watching Netflix or watching short videos on your phone or whatever it may be. But we can't just say, don't do any technology at all, because that is sort of, in your case, a gateway to all this newfound knowledge. And that, I guess, that's probably what makes this tricky for some people.
Well, I'm not anti-technology. Mm-hmm. I'm anti-using technology to replace our an active life, like using technology so that I can do nothing, as if that could be my goal. That's a terrible way to use it, because it destroys your life. But if you use it, you can use technology to become more involved, to go deeper into experiences. And that's how I advocate using it.
So maybe as we close, I mean, and this is sort of what I was thinking about maybe as I was planning the show today, is that if you went back many, many, many hundreds of years ago to our ancestors, their, like, challenge in life was to stay alive, make sure they have food, make sure they have clean water, make sure they have a roof over their head. And for most of us, that challenge has been met. So today's challenge is not looking at those external forces that we sometimes have no control over, but really challenging ourselves to become better people, to continue to move forward and continue to use technology in ways that make our lives better. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, because we seem to have been evolutionarily conditioned to need to move forward, to have the motivation to move forward, to keep working in order to survive, but also to kind of conserve energy.
Mm-hmm.
We find rest when we can find it. Then comes along all this technology that can do much of our work for us, all these labor-saving devices, and provide us entertainment so we don't get bored real easily. And suddenly we can do nothing but conserve energy. And that that can become habitual, and that's really bad. So we're really the first generation that has to purposefully seek out different kinds of challenges, or we could say work. We have to seek out certain kinds of work that we choose to do for our entire lives, as long as we want our lives to be meaningful. We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. Scott, what is your question for me?
So, Rick, over Memorial Day weekend, you just talked about how you were camping, I think, in Northeast Iowa. And I was also, Travis and I were also out of town. We were in the city of Milwaukee and had a wonderful time. We were staying in an Airbnb in a residential neighborhood. And many of the things we wanted to see, or kind of the strip of restaurants and retail stores, were across this really nice park. And the park was probably like, 7 or 8 city blocks. It was a good sized park. And as we were walking through this park several times, there were, I think, 2 large ponds or water features, and they were attracting lots of geese. And I don't know much about geese, maybe, but I don't think it's like a seasonal thing. I think they just are there anytime the water is not frozen. And as we were walking down the path, not so far from this pond, of course, there's goose droppings all over the place. I thought to myself, too, if I had kids or if I just myself wanted to, like, recreate leisurely things in the grass, I mean, I wouldn't want to go in that grass. And I know enough that some cities across our country have taken some pretty harsh tactics against these geese. And it seemed like this park in Milwaukee, they were just sort of letting geese be geese. And I guess my question for you is, at what point does preventing public spaces for people outweigh leaving nature alone?
There's no way to just leave nature alone anymore. We've modified the natural environment everywhere on the planet. And especially in cities, you know, we build parks, but there we choose every kind of plant that grows, and we've altered the landscape, the topography. Everything about those parks is artificial now. And even like if there's like a stream going by or a little pond or something, all that's been modified, right? So the question is, like, how do you manage it? How do you manage the wildlife that uses the park? And it wasn't that many years ago, just a few decades, where geese were fairly rare. You didn't see many geese. In fact, I remember my dad talking about, because he was a real avid waterfowl hunter, and he just dreamed of shooting a goose someday, like, because they'd never got an opportunity. And now there's geese all
over. Go to Milwaukee.
Right? Yeah. But we still have this kind of attitude about geese that, like, they're special in a way that, for example, that pigeons are not.
Yeah.
And most people do not have a problem with cities treating pigeons like a nuisance.
Like a rat or a rodent, yeah.
Now, some people object to it.
Yeah,
like
but
the
overall.
But overall, we tend to treat geese differently. But I think it's the same thing. Here you have a species that's no longer endangered. You're looking to balance what is the purpose of this park. And there is, I think, some public health concerns. And you know, like, if you're a parent, you're not going to let a 3-year-old
roll around
in that grass.
Because I heard, like, E. coli can be a risk, among other things, from the little bit I checked. And I kind of was looking around after this, looking at some of what other cities have done. Apparently, putting, like, at certain times of the day, letting dogs sort of run around can sort of encourage geese to call other places home. Lasers apparently are being used some places. I
had never heard of that.
Yeah, I didn't look too much into that, but I mean, I guess that's something some cities are trying. Also, some cities, there's also some that are often gather them up and then, like, gas them some places, or gather them up and maybe, like, relocate them far, far away. I don't know. But I think there would be a lot of people who, if you, like, and I know cities have made this choice of saying, you know, geese are a problem. This is a park that in the case of Milwaukee, there's probably a couple thousand people that live within an easy walk of this park. And like, that's important. And I think we want people spending more time in parks and being outside and all the things that are good about that. And if geese get in the way, well, I mean, I tend to agree with you, although I thought you might go a different way on this.
No, I thought if they were a threatened species, and this is one of the few habitats where we're finding that they flourish, but they are not, because, you know, much of their natural habitat has been destroyed, and so like they just aren't flourishing, but they happen to be doing really well in this park, I would say, well, that's worth dedicating that space. That's not the case with geese. They're doing well in all kinds of environments. And so I would appreciate like creative ways of keeping them out of the park so that it's more pleasant and safer for human beings to use. I think that's fine. You know, as somebody who's used, we use taxpayer dollars a lot for habitat restoration,
yep,
and a lot of it for wild animals, but we can also use taxpayer dollars for human recreation places. And if the geese are interfering with that, it's okay to shoo them off to someplace else.
I mean, shoo them off to someplace else or kill them too?
I'm a waterfowl hunter also.
Okay.
Like,
I'm
fine with that. That wouldn't be the first choice. Just like kill them and dump them in the landfill. That would not be.
Well, I did read too, and a little bit of
Letting the dogs go.
Yeah.
Because people can clean up after their dogs. It's like nobody's going to clean up after the geese.
Yeah, yeah. I did read too that some cities actually, I guess there's regulations that if you euthanize geese, you can't sell the meat, but people euthanize geese and then you can donate it to food shelves and stuff. So that is another option that I read about.
Hmm.
Depending a little bit on how you kill them.
How it's done, yeah.
The other thing too is I think people who listen to the show probably know, I spend a lot of time this time of the year on my bicycle, and there are a number of trails in our city where you will come, especially this time of the year, across a goose who is protecting its young, and they can be pretty nasty. And again, I don't think we should just be, I mean, I think in many cases where I'm finding them, they're probably in places where they belong, but they can be pretty aggressive. And I remember hearing a discussion once about like what animal you would be willing to fight. And the person's argument was, yeah, of course you don't want to fight a bear. You don't want to fight a lion. We all know those things. But like goose should be a lot higher on the list than you might think.
They can be pretty powerful. And yeah, I was on a trail in the city just last week, and there was a pair of geese with the little goslings. Like they had a half a dozen of them around, and they were up on the gravel of the trail, and I had to walk by them, and
yeah, walking.
One of them was hissing, you know, like spread its wings and hiss, and then starts running after me.
Yeah. And that's why I feel like safer on a bicycle, because I'm a little higher off the ground and I can move pretty quickly past them. But if you're walking, I'm not sure, you may have been running for a short time, I don't know, but it can be a little intimidating.
Yeah, they're mostly trying to scare you away.
Yes,
they're
yes.
not actually trying to attack you, but if you keep your distance, you don't walk right towards their babes, then they're a little better off.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And also, be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and that will touch on many of the topics we spoke about today. And that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.